Welcome, investors, to the Absolute Return Podcast, your source for stock market analysis, global macro musings, and hedge fund investment strategies. Your hosts, Julian Klimochko and Michael Kesslering, aim to bring you the knowledge and analysis you need to become a more intelligent and wealthier investor. This episode is brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at AccelerateShares.com.
Welcome, podcast listeners, to the Absolute Return Podcast. I'm your host, Julian Klimochko. I'm joined by my co-host, Mike Kesslering. And on today's podcast, we're welcoming special guest, Alex Shahidi, Managing Partner and Co-Chief Investment Officer at Evoke Advisors and Eris Consulting, a $19 billion registered investment advisor. Alex helps manage the RPAR Risk Parity ETF, which seeks to generate positive returns during periods of economic growth, preserve capital during periods of economic contraction, and preserve real rates of return during periods of heightened inflation. On today's podcast, Alex discusses his journey in finance, moving from a successful career at Merrill Lynch to starting his own firm, the basics of risk parity, why he launched a risk parity ETF, keys to success in the ETF business, his top investment pick, and more. To disclose, we do hold a position in the RPAR Risk Parity ETF in our Accelerate One Choice Alternative Portfolio ETF. So with no further ado, here's our discussion with Alex Shahidi, Managing Partner and Co-Chief Investment Officer at Evoke Advisors and Eris Consulting. Welcome, Alex, to the Absolute Return Podcast. Pleasure to have you on the show today. Going to talk about risk parity, ETFs, hedge fund strategies, and all that good stuff. But prior to getting into any specific investment strategies, I wanted to get into the background of your career and how you ended up running a risk parity strategy. Specifically, you have 21 years of experience in the investment business. What initially made you catch the investing bug? What was the first thing that got you into finance, and how did your career develop from that?
Thanks for having me. It's nice to see you both. So my story is maybe not that different from most, at least from a high level, which is I'm a numbers person and I love working and helping people. So investing and being a financial advisor was a very good fit for that. So that's, I think, initially what attracted me to the business. But also, I think the other thing is, and obviously passionate about investing, I think that goes without saying. But the other thing that I think is really interesting about what we do is there's an aspect of art and there's an aspect of science. And I think if you're too far in one end or the other, you miss a lot. And that's really attractive to me because I'm the type of person who gets attracted to things that have a very steep learning curve, and that learning curve stays steep. When it flattens, I start to get, you know, a little bored, and I'm looking to keep that learning curve steep. And the world of investing and dealing with clients and investors and, you know, the kind of the art and science that encompasses all of that, makes this a pretty unique industry where the learning curve is always steep.
So you started out at Merrill Lynch, had a successful start to your career there, and was there for quite a while, built a successful practice. What made you kind of strike out on your own co-founding Eris with a business partner and, you know, becoming to what you are today? What was the spark? What was the idea behind that?
Let me just give you a little background for my approach. So I start off by saying my story is, you know, fairly similar from a high level, but then it really diverges from here on out. So when I went to law school, I graduated, took the bar and passed, and a week later I started at Merrill Lynch, which isn't a typical path for somebody who takes the bar exam.
Right.
But that was my passion. That's what I wanted to do. Law was more from an educational perspective. It also teaches you to think in shades of gray, you know, whereas, you know, I'm a numbers person, so I see the world in black and white, and law school teaches you shades of gray. And that's a really good balance for developing a practice in our industry. So I get to Merrill Lynch. I'm really excited. And they give you a phone and a computer and they say, go get clients. And then I started to realize, you know what, this is not so much an investment, mindset. It's more of like a marketing. And so when you look around the industry, the people who tend to be the most successful and those who survive tend to be really good salespeople, and they're good at communicating to clients, building relationships, and they're less oriented towards the investment side. And I'm more of an investor. I'm not marketing oriented at all. And so that immediately set me on a very different path. And so I came in and they tell you, you know, if you're spending, you know, more than 10% of your time in the office, you're on the wrong track. And because you need to be out of the office getting clients. And I just thought, you know, I need to be really good at what I do. I need to get my arms around investing and develop a strategy. So I spent 90% of my time in the office, almost the exact opposite of what they taught you. And I spent a lot of time getting designations, you know, like the CFA, the CIMA, CFP, because it's structured form of learning. I read everything I could. I was probably reading 14 to 16 hours a day. I tried to find people who I thought were insightful, learn from them. And that, to me, is a very different approach than what I've seen in the industry. And so what it did is it put me in a very different place where I viewed myself as an independent advisor that just happened to be working in Merrill Lynch. And they have great, you know, tools and resources. But I spent my time trying to find what I thought was the best insight and share that with my clients. So I did that for 15 years, and Merrill gave me a lot of flexibility. I was managing over $10 billion in assets there. And that worked out for a long time until we got to about 2014, when I felt I needed more tools in my toolkit in order to properly manage client portfolios. We'll talk about how I think about that in a second. And so it was time to depart and launch my own firm with my partner, Damien Basserier, who was at Bridgewater for about a decade. So we'd been talking about working together for, you know, 7-8 years, and finally the stars aligned. He left Bridgewater, I left Merrill, and we launched our firm, Aris, in 2014. And basically I was able to transition my clients over. It was a continuation of what I was doing before, but now I had the flexibility to create new tools. For example, we launched an ETF. We create commingled vehicles. I published the book that was published by Wiley that came out in 2014. So a lot of things have happened since then. And then more recently, we merged with another firm called Evoke Advisors. And it's a group that I had known for 15 years. I worked with them at Merrill, led by David Ho and Mark Sear. And so we merged together. So now we're a $20 billion RIA in Los Angeles. So that's kind of my career in a nutshell.
And it sounds like things are going fantastic with $20 billion in AUM, managed accounts sort of spun off from Merrill Lynch. And then there's the concept of two concepts. Number one is an ETF. Number two is risk parity. So you launched the RPAR risk parity ETF. How did that come about? And, you know, what was the idea behind launching risk parity within an exchange-traded fund?
Sure. So a step back to provide a little context. So this idea of risk parity, and I think of that as just a balanced portfolio, is something that I've been following and implementing for clients on a separate account basis for about 15 years. And it's these are concepts that I learned originally from Bridgewater. They have a strategy that's been doing this for a long time. This is how Ray Dalio, their founder, manages his family's wealth and so on.
That's the all-weather, the Bridgewater all-weather strategy, right?
That's correct. And so when I first was introduced to that concept, I spent a lot of time thinking about it. I did about 2 years of research trying to get my arms around, does this really make sense? I ended up writing a book about it. They actually helped me. They provided data. They gave me feedback.
And what's the book?
Ray, it's called Balanced Asset Allocation.
Okay, great.
It came out in 2014. And by the way, we're doing an update currently, and that one will come out later this year, which is more direct to the risk parity fund that we have. So I've been doing this for a long time. And one thing that I learned is there's a lot of challenges with implementing a strategy like that, and I'll describe what the strategy is. But it's difficult to do on a individual basis for clients. And so over the last few years, we've been exploring, is there a better way to do this? Can we be more efficient? And we figured out, okay, if we take the strategy and we put it inside of a vehicle, then there's implementation efficiencies, obviously, because we can just manage one vehicle rather than individual portfolios. But we discovered all these other efficiencies. There's tax efficiency, there's lower costs, you get great liquidity, you can lever at near zero cost. There's all these advantages, which I'll get into. But by taking what we were already doing, putting it inside of a vehicle, and then using that for our clients gained a lot of efficiencies. And most importantly, it gave us the ability to be more balanced than we were before. And so that's the genesis for why we came up with the idea and why we did it. And you know, a large percentage of the assets in there are from our clients that we shared the story with, and they thought it made sense. But it's grown way beyond that. And part of it is because you don't know this in advance, but we launched it right before a global pandemic. And normally when you launch something before a global pandemic, unless you happen to be in the exact right industry, like Zoom, for example, it's usually not good timing. And so in this case, it was perfect timing because there's a philosophy, which I'll describe, of being able to protect in a downturn, participate in up markets with a very simple strategy that anybody can understand. And we put it into the world right before the global pandemic. So in 1 year, which is 2020, you basically saw the equivalent of, let's say, a 3-year bear market in 3 months. And then you saw, you know, maybe a 7-year bull market in 3 quarters. And so you got 1 year of a live track record, but it's like 10 years of experience. So you got to test it because you got, you know, one of the worst declines, the steepest declines, one of the steepest in history. And then you got this unbelievable rebound, even while the pandemic raged on. And that turn is really difficult to predict. So all these things you get to throw into a short time period. And it succeeded through that downturn and recovery. And I think that's one of the reasons the assets are, you know, almost $1.2 billion now, is because, one, the concept is easy to understand and transparent. And two, it kind of proved itself in a relatively short period of time.
And now a word from our sponsor, Accelerate, one of Canada's most innovative and fastest growing alternative investment solution providers. With a suite of institutional caliber alternative ETFs for investors seeking diversification and long-term performance, the Accelerate One Choice Alternative Portfolio ETF, symbol 1C, ONEC on the TSX, is Canada's first alternatives portfolio solution, providing exposure to 6 alternative asset classes, 10 alternative strategies, in one easy-to-use, one-choice ETF that charges a management fee of just 0.2%. The Accelerate One Choice Alternative Portfolio ETF trades under the symbol 1C, ONEC, on the Toronto Stock Exchange. Find out more at accelerateshares.com.
So for some of our listeners that aren't really familiar with what risk parity is, can you just describe some of the basics and why it would be deserving of a spot in an investor's portfolio?
Sure. I think the way to think about it is from a high level, is we're trying to solve a very important problem that all investors face. So one is you want high returns. So think of it like equity-like returns. You want low fees, low taxes, and liquidity. That's, you know, very simple request, right? Just give me all those things and I'll be happy. And I think that's actually doable within this construct. So low fees, low taxes, liquidity, if you just take whatever your strategy is, put it in an ETF, you get that. Okay, but equity-like returns with controlled risk. So how do you get equity-like returns with controlled risk over the long run? So you're investing for, you know, 20, 30, 40 years. How do you build something that gets you there? I think the starting point, you have to think of it from a blank slate. So forget everything you know. So if you ask the average investor, you know, you have 50 years to invest, what do you buy? They say you buy stocks and you don't look at it ever again. And don't sell low, just hold on. I think there's a better way. And so the concept here basically is trying to achieve equity-like returns with controlled risk by taking two key steps. One is, which asset classes do you select for your portfolio? And then the second step is, how do you structure the asset classes? Okay, so going back to step one, we want a portfolio that is diverse, okay, because we're trying to control risk. So you pick asset classes that go up and down at different times. Okay, so it's really as simple as that. And the way to think about that is to recognize that the main driver of asset class returns is the economic environment. Okay, it's not you know, much else. It's you know, if, for example, the economy collapses, you know, growth falls, you already know that equities are going to do poorly, and you know that things like treasuries will do well. So this is what happened in Q1 of last year. If inflation is the big driver, so like the 1970s, if inflation surprises to the upside, then that is good for certain assets and it's bad for other assets. And so if you think in those terms, you're not even thinking about correlation, you're not thinking about anything else, you're just thinking of fundamentally, which assets are biased to do well when growth is rising and which are biased to do well when growth is falling, and which assets are biased to do well when inflation is rising and when inflation is falling. And this is all relative to what's already discounted, which's really interesting is it's about 50-50 in terms of which way the economy goes. About half the time it outperforms expectations and half the time it underperforms. So it's really hard to predict, which of these things is going to happen. So recognizing that the economic environment is what is the main driver, pick asset classes that do well in different environments. So we pick four. It's equities, commodities, TIPS, and treasuries. Okay, so equities do well when growth is rising and inflation is falling. Commodities do well when inflation is rising and growth is rising. And then within commodities, there's two. There's gold, which is a storehold of wealth. And then there are the producers, like energy, miners, agriculture. Those do a little bit differently during growth. So when growth is rising, it's good for commodity producers, like this year. They're doing really well. They got crushed in Q1 of last year. And the opposite for gold. So gold was up in Q1 of last year and is down this year. So that all makes sense. And then TIPS have the opposite bias of equities. They do well when the economy is weak and when inflation is rising. Like the 1970s would have been a great time for TIPS. And then you have treasuries, which nobody likes because the yield is low. But what's interesting about treasuries is they do well when the economy is weak and they do well when inflation is falling. So heading into Q1 of last year, nobody wanted to own treasuries. It was the best performing asset. Right? And if you go back to Japan the last 30 years, it's been one of the best performing assets actually in the world, even though yields were low because you got an economic collapse and a deflationary depression. So pick four asset classes because they're reliably diverse. You don't even have to predict which one's going to do well or poorly. You just know that they're going to zig and zag at different times. So step one, pick asset classes that are diverse. You're not worried about what their returns are, right? You just know that they're diverse. Step two is structure each to have a similar return and risk. Okay? And so what I mean by that is that if you can take these asset classes, rather than taking them as they're prepackaged, you think of it a little bit more thoughtfully, where each of them, if you're investing for 100 years, you should expect similar returns and risk. Okay, and so you can do that fairly easily. So equities obviously have an equity-like return and risk. Commodities, rather than buying commodity futures, we buy commodity producer equities that over 50 years have beat equities by 2% a year. But because they act too much like equities, you combine it with gold bullion. And those two combined, and gold is uncorrelated to equities, obviously. And those two combined, when you put them together, you have a commodity basket that has an expected return and risk that's comparable to equities. So now you've got equities with equity-like return and risk, commodities with an equity-like return and risk. Then TIPS and treasuries are normally lower returning, lower risk assets. There's two levers you can pull to raise the return and risk. One, longer duration bonds. This is, everybody's going shorter duration these days. I'm saying to be balanced, you should go longer duration. It's the opposite of what the current tendency is. And you do that to increase the return, it increases the risk. But that's not enough, because that's not enough to get to equity-like risk. So you add a modest amount of leverage. And if you do that, and you go back 100 years, treasuries and equities have the same return and risk, right? TIPS and equities can have similar return and risk. Okay, now you have four asset classes that you know are diverse, each of which has a similar return and risk over the long run. And now you just balance across all of them and you constantly rebalance, which is a repeated process of buying low, selling high, which can add another 0.5% or 1% on average over time. And so that's the conceptual framework. And then you just buy indexes for those underlying components and you just rebalance. And in a period, of a downturn like Q1 of last year, commodities and equities got crushed. And the ETF was down 4%, right, in Q1. Market was down 21. Then the reverse happened. And what was the worst the first quarter? Equities and commodities were the best the next three quarters. What was the best in the first quarter? Treasuries was the worst the next three quarters as interest rates rose. And the ETF was up about 25% in the last three quarters. And it finished the year up a little over 19%. So protect on the downside, participate on the upside. And there was no timing aspect at all. It was just maintaining balance.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Accelerate, one of Canada's most innovative and fastest-growing alternative investment solution providers. With a suite of institutional-caliber alternative ETFs for investors seeking diversification and long-term performance, the Accelerate Arbitrage Fund, symbol ARB on the TSX, is the world's first SPAC-focused ETF with a diversified portfolio of SPAC and merger arbitrage opportunities in an easy-to-use, low-cost ETF. The Accelerate Arbitrage Fund ETF trades under the symbol ARB on the Toronto Stock Exchange. Find out more at accelerateshares.com.
And so when you look at your investor base and kind of your target market that the strategy would be suitable for, where are you seeing that? Are you seeing it being most popular amongst institutional investors and family offices, as you had mentioned, Ray Dalio using it to manage his own wealth as well as their firm's strategy? Are you seeing it more on the institutional side, or is there a real use case in retail as well?
Yeah, you know, we've seen a mix where high net worth clients tend to really like it because there's a very strong tax efficient argument for mixing, you know, multiple asset classes inside of a single ETF vehicle, because you can effectively rebalance without generating cap gains. And so for high net worth, it's very attractive. For institutions, it's attractive because it's a low cost way to get exposure to a diverse set of asset classes. And so we're seeing interest across both of those dimensions so far.
I wanted to get a bit into the weeds, Alex, on how the strategy works. Specifically, you mentioned the four asset classes: equities, treasuries, commodities, and TIPS. Now, do you have an outlook on each of these? I know this is a mechanical, systematic strategy. Actually, let me rephrase that. Perhaps because each one of these asset classes performs well in a different environment, do you have a forecast for what sort of environment we're heading into that would drive returns for each one of these asset classes?
You know, it's a great question. You know, the answer for the most part is we do have our opinions, but the strategy doesn't reflect that. And the reason is that our experience is it's really hard to time these things consistently well. And so the strategy here is to effectively build a neutral portfolio that is indifferent to what the economic outcome is, because it's equally balanced across all those different environments. So for the most part, it doesn't really care, right? It's not necessarily biased to do well or poorly in any of those environments. And so we think of this as kind of a core allocation where you're equally allocated across all these economic outcomes. Then, if you want to express a tilt, you can do it outside of the ETF. And to us, that's I think a very good way to do it, because everybody has different views. Number one. Number two, we have much greater conviction in the benefits and viability of being well balanced and diversified than we do in any single bet. Because you're going to be right more often than not by betting on diversification than you are in your individual convictions of what's going to happen next. And as we've seen, completely unexpected things can happen. We just went through two major ones, right? You had a global pandemic where the unemployment rate quadrupled in 2 months. Nobody expected that 6 months earlier, and the stock market fell 33% in 5 weeks. Okay, so that was very, really hard to anticipate. Then you had this unbelievable recovery. While the pandemic was raging on, the bottom was in, was a year ago. Like, how could you see that happening? And if you miss those major inflection points on the way down and on the way up, that could wipe out years of picking, guessing correctly. And so I think there's a very valuable lesson from last year where unexpected things can happen. If you try to time, you're going to miss sometimes, and those misses could be very painful. And so if you have something that can be down 4% and up 19.5% in a year like that without having to guess at all, right, that tells you something as far as the value of kind of just being neutral all the time.
So you mentioned earlier that step one of developing a risk parity strategy is to pick a diverse set of asset classes. How would you go about thinking into the future about adding a new asset class as the investing landscape changes?
Yeah, it's a great question. If we were sitting here talking 25 years ago, TIPS hadn't been invented yet, at least in the US. And it's a tremendous asset class because it has the opposite bias of equities. And so I think it would make sense to always be open to adding asset classes because more diversification is typically better. But the key is to really understand what its economic bias is. Because when you throw these things into your portfolio, what you want to be mindful of is to not overweight any economic outcome. So you'll notice one of the things that I did not mention in our asset classes is corporate bonds, which is a very popular asset class. We don't include it because it has the same bias as equities. It does well when the economy is doing well, and it does poorly when the economy is doing poorly. And it has a similar inflation bias. And so it doesn't really add a lot by adding it into the portfolio. So it's not so much about throwing more asset classes in. It's more about adding asset classes that are truly diverse, that zig and zag at different times. And so if something like that comes along, I certainly think it would be something that might be worth consideration. And you could think of cryptocurrency as a potential in that regard. You know, we have gold, maybe it's a good diversifier to gold. It's still, you know, gold has a couple thousand year head start on cryptocurrency, which is about 10 years old. But something like that could, you know, find its way into the portfolio once it, you know, it doesn't swing around as much and has more institutional ownership and, you know, all the other things. But definitely something to consider.
It's interesting, the notion of including additional asset classes, obviously looking at correlations, return drivers, return expectations, and such. But digging into RPAR, it's been incredibly successful in the market, launched in 2019, now gathering $1.2 billion in assets in a relatively short amount of time. What are the keys to success in being successful in ETFs? What did you find really worked for you guys?
Besides the lucky timing of, you know, right before a global pandemic and doing well through that, which is hard to replicate, I'd say probably the most important thing is to have a strategy that is, first of all, sound, and two, that you can explain in simple terms that anybody can understand, and you have a transparent approach that is easy to follow and easy to understand how it's performing, you know, what is in there and why it's performing as it is. I think that's the key to long-term success, because I think most investors are prone to chasing returns. When something goes up in the rearview mirror, their eyes get attracted to it and they want to buy it. And then when it goes down, they sell it and they look for the next thing that's done well. And that doesn't generally lead to good long-term returns. If you took an honest assessment of, you know, chasing returns, it has a terrible track record. And so our goal is to have something that's simple, that's easy to understand, that's transparent, and has an approach that intuitively makes sense to get investors to buy into the concept. Then they're less prone to want to sell when it's underperforming and less prone to add when it's outperforming, and hopefully have the opposite, meaning when it's outperforming, maybe you trim a little bit. When it's underperforming, you add a little bit. And over time, that actually leads to even a better result. And so I think that's a big part of what I think is underappreciated in our industry is I think there's a tendency to try to make things sound more complicated than they really are. And there are strategies that the investors really don't know what they own. They're just happy when it's doing well and upset when it's doing poorly. And I think if you can explain things and have a simple story with a track record and transparency and repeatedly try to educate your investors, then that can lead to long-term success. That's one of the reasons we're doing another edition of the book, just because I want people to, who are interested in learning about what the risk parity approach is, they can read it and understand everything they need to know. And, you know, hopefully that'll make them, you know, long-term investors and holders of the strategy.
And in terms of track record, were you running the strategy prior to launching the ETF?
Yeah, we were doing it for individual clients for a long period of time. And I mean, you could just look at these asset classes over, you know, some of them have been around 50 years, some of them 100 years. And you can just look at their returns and you can see the periods where they do well, the periods that they do poorly. And if you just take this diverse mix of asset classes, you could just look at the numbers yourself and see that they do well at different times. You know, people remember the bull market of equities the last 10 years. But often they forget the previous 10 years, the 2000s of that decade, equities were negative for a decade. And commodities were actually the best thing to own. In the last decade, what everybody remembers, commodities were terrible. so nobody wants to own them now, and equities are the best. But these things flip-flop all the time. You know, in the 1970s, equities and treasuries underperformed cash for a decade, and gold was up 30% a year, right? And then just when you think that's the thing to own, the next 20 years, gold was negative for 20 years, right? So it's not easy picking what's going to do the best, you know? And so being diversified across all of them prevents you from being, you know, outperforming the best asset class, but also prevents you from underperforming, and you're kind of in the middle. And the middle is a great place to be because it's a much more stable return stream, especially if you can, you know, have equity-like returns over a very long period of time.
Yeah, certainly the balanced approach makes sense conceptually. Obviously, what we run into as investors is, you know, everyone wants to pick the next hot thing. Everyone wants to speculate. So, Alex, I want to put you on the spot here. If you could only hold one investment for the next 10 years, excluding ARPA, Risk Parity, what would it be and why?
That was going to be my answer, so you took that away.
Well, let's assume it's ARPAR and then something else.
Sure. You know, first I would say I give it, you know, this might be like a 55% conviction level, okay, you know, as opposed to throwing a dart and be 50%. But I think commodities probably look relatively attractive. And the reason I say that is because, one, they've, you know, if you just look at what's done the worst, oftentimes that's the best the next period. And that's been one of the worst places to be the last decade. Two is you're starting to see inflation pressures emerge and you know, the you know, more limited supply of commodities. So those dynamics seem to be, you know, leading towards, you know, supply-demand mismatch. And you know, we'll see what happens.
Okay, great. I like that call. Would it be hard to imagine commodities doing well, as you indicated? The 2000s, they had a knockout of a decade, but have really been crashed over the previous decade. Ultimately, who knows? Balanced approach makes sense. So prior to letting you go today, where can potential investors find about more about ARPAR? In addition, tell us about the book.
Sure. The website is arparetf.com. We're constantly updating it with information. We're trying to educate our clients. We do a quarterly webcast. We send out monthly emails. We just want educated investors because I want them to know what they own and why they own it. We also have our advisory website, evokeadvisors.com. We have a lot of content on there. We're very focused on providing, you know, educational material. And the book is called Balanced Asset Allocation that came out in 2014. There's a risk parity book that's coming out later this year that I'm still in the middle of writing, but that's kind of the second edition of the first one.
Well, the pandemic is a great time to be writing a book, I suppose. But Alex, thank you for coming on the show today. Really great insights into risk parity and your success in finance thus far in your career, and look for continued success in the future. So thank you very much. We enjoyed the discussion.
I did as well. Thank you for having me.
All right. Take care.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks for tuning in to the Absolute Return Podcast. This episode was brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com. The views expressed in this podcast are the personal views of the participants and do not reflect the views of Accelerate. No aspect of this podcast constitutes investment, legal, or tax advice. Opinions expressed in this podcast should not be viewed as a recommendation or solicitation of an offer to buy or sell any securities or investment strategies. The information and opinions in this podcast are based on current market conditions and may fluctuate and change in the future. No representation or warranty expressed or implied is made on behalf of Accelerate as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Accelerate does not accept any liability for any direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage suffered by any person as a result of relying on all or any part of this podcast, and any liability is expressly disclaimed.